Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
It's a fucking disgrace.
Oh, it's not a bad ball for Pelé on the right side. It's Carlos Alberto. And what a great goal that was. Carlos Alberto.
Maradona just walked away from Huddle then. Maradona. Smoked and
Argentina the lead, the England players protesting to the referee.
De halve finale komen. Ik heb opeens zo'n gevoel dat we in de halve finale gaan komen. Met het balbezit voor Frank de Boer. Frank de Boer speelt de bal heel goed naar Dennis Bergkamp. Dennis Bergkamp! Dennis Bergkamp neemt de bal aan! Dennis Bergkamp!
Dennis Bergkamp! Dennis Bergkamp!
So hello and welcome back to the Scoreless Thriller podcast. I'm Alex and I'm joined as always by Leon. Leon, how are you doing?
Great and very happy to be here.
And we're delighted to be joined by Brazilian-based football journalist Tim Vickery. Tim has covered South American football for close to 30 years and for the BBC and a range of other publications. And we're delighted to have you on the podcast today, Tim.
Lovely to be here. Let's kick the ball around a little bit.
Sounds good.
So this discussion has sort of been triggered. I mean, last time on the podcast, we talked about Diego Maradona, and this week we're going to be discussing Pele. And I was triggered by it to sort of start this discussion and cover this topic by the recent Netflix documentary on Pele. But to sort of begin to kind of get this ball rolling a little bit, for people of my generation, it can be sometimes hard to just kind of quantify quite how good Pele is and trying to like understand quite what made him different to players beforehand, because we try and watch the clips and sometimes, you know, it looks a little bit iffy and there's lots of kind of jokes around the defending that he may have faced and stuff like this. So for you, Tim, like, what was the kind of quantum leap that Pele brought to football from before and what made him special?
Well, I think it was really sweet to see recently the kind of exchange of mutual respect and admiration between Pele and Cristiano Ronaldo. You know, when Cristiano overtook his number of goals in official games. And I thought that was really sweet, that exchange between them, because so often I think, as you alluded, Alex, it becomes almost like a generational war with the kids. The kids just disparaging anything that happened back then. And with the oldies saying, well, nothing that the likes of Messi and Cristiano Ronaldo can do can ever live up to what Pele did. And obviously, I mean, it's very hard to compare over eras. And the comparison and the conclusion I think that we have to reach is, anyway, you're all welcome to your opinion about who was the best and so on. But let's celebrate all of these. You know, they belong to all of us. And let's celebrate them. In terms of Pele, I think he was probably the perfect footballing machine, both technically and psychologically. I think his defenders and he himself have probably done him a disservice by stressing so much the 1,000 goals thing, because I don't think the greatness of Pele is measured in statistical accumulation. Because it then opens up to the kind of things that you're alluding to then about, you know, look at the opposition and so on, you know. One of the truths about Pele is that, like all truly, truly great players, he was often at his best when it really mattered. The great players come out when the stakes are highest. Pelé was... There's a clip that I like to show people. It's from the final of the Club World Cup, Benfica against Santos at the end of 62, when he's absolutely at his peak. Now, this competition, it started in 1960 between the winners of the European Cup, the Champions League as it now is, and the Copa Libertadores in South America, home and away. And for a few years, this competition was fantastic. Unfortunately, come the late 60s, it began to become overtaken by violence, and it became discredited and discontinued and so on. And it's one of those branches of football history that's been forgotten. But for a few years, it was the best club football spectacle that existed. And this was a huge game. Away to Benfica, the first leg in Brazil, Santos had won 3-2. That's a narrow lead to take back to Europe, to Benfica, and Benfica consider themselves the favourites. And Pelé put Santos 5-0 up. And you look at him, and he's playing against European champions. And he's just running through them as if he's someone from a different species. He was technically perfect. He had everything, right foot, left foot, in the air, quick, could change direction, intelligent, had a wonderful peripheral vision, but also he was psychologically very, very, very good. He's a perfect synthesis. The two big motivational forces in life are pride and fear, and he had them both very, very strongly. He had the pride of his father, who's an easygoing fella, who was a good footballer, and had lots of pride in his profession. He's got the fear of his mother, who's paralyzed by the fear of not being able to feed all of her kids, and is dead set against him becoming a footballer because it's not financially secure. So Pelé makes sure that if he's going to make his living that way, he's going to be great and he's going to make money from it. And that spurs him on as well. True, he doesn't have the World Cup in 86 that Maradona has. That would have been 62, but he gets injured in the second game. Yeah. Pelé is still unbelievable in 58 and in 70, but the World Cup doesn't see him right at its very, very at his absolute peak as it did with Maradona in 86. True, he doesn't have the influence of Di Stefano, who is the last great product of Argentina's golden age. Is great there, goes and launches Colombian football and makes them a power, and then comes over and changes the history, not only of European football, but of the European continent with the European Cup. You know, remember Spain at the time, it's only 10 years after the Second World War, and Spain is still ruled by General Franco. It's like a relic from the Second World War. Everyone hates Spain until Di Stefano's Real Madrid start putting on shows, and then Spain becomes a valued tourist venue. Di Stefano changes the course of European history. Pelé's not as quite as influential of that, although he's perhaps the principal one responsible for the World Cup becoming such a television event. So he doesn't quite have that, but he's maybe the best footballing machine that there's ever been. You can laugh about some of the defending, but you know, those Benfica defenders, those Italy defenders in 1970, they're the best that's around. Mm-hmm. And he's making them look stupid. So he's ahead of the game in terms of his physical preparation. He's fantastically mentally prepared. He wants to use the game as a means of making money, which is relatively new, you know. He is probably the most complete footballing machine that there has ever been.
Mm-hmm. And what was it about Brazil in that sort of period between sort of 58 and 70, which, you know, allowed them to sort of create these repeat brilliant teams that sort of, and also culturally sort of capture people's footballing imagination?
Well, it's a big country, and football's the only mass sport, so that helps. They're beginning to get money from it, and professionalism. Without professionalism, there is no Pelé.
Yeah.
Professionalism comes in the mid-30s, so you know, that's going to attract talented people into the game. But also, they took it very, very seriously, and there's never any success in life without failure. Losing at home in 1950 was a huge psychological blow, but also it just forced them to think about it a little bit more. And in those years between 58 and 70, it's not just a case of the individual talent, because one of the great rules of football is that the talent shines when the collective balance of the team is right. If you just put talent out there, it tends not to work. You know, like Messi against Bayern Munich last year when Bayern went 8-2. Talent on its own is at the top level, it's not enough. What Brazil have is fantastic organisation. They're taking things really, really seriously. They've got a whole backup as far back as 58. They've got team doctors, they've got dentists, they've got physical preparation specialists. And England went to the World Cup in 62 without even a doctor. You know, Brazil are totally organised. And the man behind this is João Havelange, who later goes on to become FIFA president. But he made his name in football administration, being the head of Brazil's FA. And he gets them very, very organised. Their physical preparation is better than anyone else. They get their players fit. And one of the reasons they thought afterwards for their failure in 66 was that the physical preparation specialist for that team was a judo fella, not a football fella. Now, at that time in 66, physical preparation in English football meant running around the pitch four times and then going to play golf all day. You know, so they really
meet up after the pub.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. 1970, they only played one game at altitude, the final. In Mexico City, the other games were at Guadalajara, closer to sea level. But they've done a special physical preparation training, with a lot of it borrowed from the experience of astronauts in the United States to prepare them for the extreme conditions. And one of the players, Rivelino, he told me that, you know, we were so fit, and the games were played in scalding midday heat. He said, I don't ever remember going over to the sideline to want to drink water. You know, they were really physically, so they had a physical edge. And also tactically, because, and this is one of the things that comes out of the defeat in 1950, they've developed the back four. Mm. And where, you know, the default is still, in most of the world, it's still the WM system, where essentially you're defending with three. They bring an extra man back into the heart of the defence. It means that the midfield, because in 58, it really is 4-2-4. The midfield is undermanned, but they've got a player there, the left winger, Zagallo, who will come back. He's one of the first players, if you like, to have two shirts, you know, to be an attacking left fielder, but also to funnel back and an attacking left winger, but also to funnel back and be a midfielder as well. And that extra defence, that extra layer of defence they had with the back four meant that in 58, they didn't concede a goal till the semi-finals. The kind of stereotypical view of, you know, you just get 11 talented players off the beach and send them out.
Samba football.
Especially with Brazil, right? Yeah, and they don't care if they concede six goals as long as they score seven. That is absolutely false. It's never been like that. You've got to win here. It's all about winning. They worked out that with a little bit more defensive cover, they would get more value from their moments of individual brilliance. So for those years from 58 until 70, they had a lead in terms of organisation, in terms of physical preparation, and also the individual talents, and also tactical organisation. That starts to change in 74 when Holland come along. Because that's something new, you know, the total football of the Dutch, the pressing of the Dutch is something new. And it took Brazil a long time to kind of formulate a response to it.
Although they already talk about this after 1966, right? Because that's when they say that something of the beauty of the rawness of football is lost.
And it may well be true that the 1970 team wouldn't have won in Europe. They would have found it. I mean, the midfield playmaker, Gerson, a wonderful player, a fantastic passer of the ball over long range, but he was smoking 60 a day, and he wasn't an athlete. if the games had been played in Europe, where it was cooler and the opposition could have pressed him more, I think they might have had problems. Certainly, the greatness of the 58 side is that they were the only ones to been able to win in Europe. Man for man, I don't think there's any doubt. If you were to pick a team of the 58 side and the 70 side, the 58 side would have many more players than the 1970 side. I think the 58 side were better. But the 70 side have one very, very powerful advantage, and that's television. Mm-hmm. It was the first one that was seen in most of the world live on TV. And the images from Mexico were just fantastic. You know, it just looks, even in black and white, yeah. It looks magical. So that's one of the reasons that 70 is more valued internationally than 58. But 58, I think, is probably the greatest achievement.
Mm-hmm. We spoke. Go ahead,
Leon. But it's also the beauty of the storyline, right? The hero that after the one championship where he couldn't really play suddenly returns, and there's so much doubt whether Pepe will be able to perform to such an extent in 1970 again, and then he actually manages and carries forward the team. And I think it's also this story that is so powerful, which is why this World Cup is in the center so much.
It's the classic story in three acts, isn't it?
Yeah. You know,
the hero emerges, he's fantastic, and then the hero is challenged and there are doubts, and then the hero returns and leaves the scene. And he could have easily played 1974, but he didn't want to, because he knows that he's one of the reasons that he doesn't play 74 is he wants to leave the scene with the messages of 1970. And it's interesting, it was very quickly forgotten in Brazil afterwards for obvious reasons, but there were plenty who didn't think he should have played 70. It was a debate in the local media.
I mean, even the coach, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, Saldanha lost his job as a coach. And one of the reasons there was he'd fallen out with Pelé. Yeah. But the fella who'd coached the team in 62 was also writing articles saying, we got to drop Pelé. You've got to get him out of the side. All of that was forgotten very, very quickly when people saw the evidence that, you know, and he really made sure that he was prepared to leave the scene. He's past his peak. Although he's only 29, he's past his peak. He doesn't quite run with the ball. Because on Pelé, if you look at, say, 62, 63, when he's running with the ball, it's different from Maradona, where the ball is tied to his left foot. With Pelé, the ball is like an obedient little puppy dog, jumping around at his feet. But it was a magnificent sight. It's one of those things. I don't often wish I was older, but one thing I do wish I was older was to have been able to have seen that in the stadiums. One of the greatest stories that I've heard about Pelé was, in his attacking partner in 70 was Tostão. Tostão was the centre forward, and improvised as a centre forward in 70. Now, Tostão was the kid who went to the 66 World Cup and with Pelé as well. And Brazil trained quite close to where Tostão was from. And Tostão, so he's with the squad, and Pelé's with the squad. He takes his dad to meet Pelé. And his dad is, you know, an intelligent bloke, a serious bloke. Yeah. I can't remember what his profession was, but, you know, he's not an idiot. He's a football fanatic. And when Tostão presents Pelé to his dad breaks down crying. He says, you know, it was like my dad was meeting God, you know. That tells you something about how good Pelé was.
Yeah. Well, what do you think? Because I think it wasn't purely sort of his footballing prowess, but like, what was it about Pelé that he was sort of able to become the first sort of global footballing superstar in a commercial way, which hadn't really been seen before?
Well, timing. I think timing's got a lot to do with it, and just catching the start of the television age. It's such a big change in football. It changes the finances. I mean, it didn't really happen in club football for another 25 years. It's not really until the 90s that football really becomes a made-for-TV thing. I was born in 1965, and in all of my youth in England, you didn't get any live football on TV. There was the FA Cup final. There was the European Cup final. There was the annual game between England and Scotland. You might have another couple of England games during the year, but not all of the England games. But there was the World Cup. And so on the World Cup was a made for TV event before it happened to the club game. Which it's one of the things that gave the World Cup this unbelievable status, you know, because everyone watched all the games, you know, with months to go before the World Cup, you're getting excited about, oh, wow, it's going to be Chile against Australia in you know, and Pelé just catches the start of that, so he's the first perhaps global TV star of the game.
And he also has such a winning
because of his relationship with the World Cup. Yeah, I mean, the personalities, and he's inherited his dad's easygoing smile. Yeah. He's a tougher character.
Yeah.
But that smile, you know, but part of the drive of Pelé, and they all pay a price. You pay a price for what you do in life. Part of his drive is, I fear that he will go to his grave not able to feel financially secure. It's what child poverty does to you, you know. And my mum is this, you know. My mum, you know, when a bill comes at her house, even today, her hand shakes. You know, you can't get rid of child poverty and the insecurity that Pelé's family had, especially when his dad.
In this documentary, or why is something that he's conscious of?
Yes, yeah, I think, and it took months of negotiation, but I think he. And he's obsessed with his legacy. He has every right to be obsessed with his legacy. And there's been a very interesting generational switch in the last few years, because it used to be the case that Pelé, good bloke, Maradona, bad bloke. And the younger generations, they haven't accepted that now.
Yeah, it's been flipped, that Maradona is the charismatic rogue and Pelé is the company man.
Exactly. And Pelé knows that there are criticisms voiced about him and things that he did and things that he didn't do. And he knows that, you know, he wants to control as much of the narrative as he can, even after he's gone. Hence the fact that I think he made himself open to the questions in this documentary.
And I think, like, during the documentary, he seems sort of want to repeat sort of ad nauseum a kind of sense of modesty, or like how it was never about him. In your experience of sort of reading and covering him, does this sort of correlate to the reality of him? Because for
not
me,
at
it's,
all.
Yeah.
Not at all. That's Pelé trying to do public relations for Pelé. One of the Brazil's most important football writer was a fellow called Nelson Rodriguez. He was actually a playwright, and he was a very, very clever fella, and just a fantastic writer. He's one of those people who, once you put one of his books down, his voice is still inside your head. And I don't think he saw very well. He didn't have very good eyesight, but he picked it up. Well, yeah. In the build-up to the 58 World Cup, and remember that Brazil were nowhere near considered amongst the favourites for the 58 World Cup. In the build-up, he's saying, we're the best in the world. We're going to win this. And he sees Garrincha, that not a lot of people had really seen. And he sees Gigi. He sees the virtues of the big centre-back, Bellini. But more than anything else, he's already seen Pelé. Now, I remember Nelson is writing from Rio, and Pelé's playing his football in the state of São Paulo. He doesn't come to Rio that much, but Nelson has seen him. And the main virtue that he picks out as being the best thing that Pelé has is the absolute lack of modesty. You know, you ask Pelé after the game, who was the best on the field? And he'll say, I think I was. Who's the best player in this position in Brazil? I think I am. You know, absolute lack of modesty. And Nelson Rodriguez identifies this. He's the first one to call him the king. He's saying, this is exactly what we need, you know, because we are the best. Let's stop cowering in front of the opposition and let's go out and show that we are the best. And Pelé carried, and I'm all in favour of a bit of arrogance, you know. Bring it on, bring it on. You know, I think I haven't actually seen the documentary. Netflix is for younger people. You know, the wife and my stepdaughter, I think they do it, but I don't know how to do it. I've spent a lot of time talking about the documentary, but I've still never seen it. But these efforts at modesty, he knows he's great.
Yeah.
You know, and he always did, and that's one of the reasons that he was so great. So I can understand if you got the feeling that was a little bit forced.
No, I mean, I feel like it would have come across more genuine if he had sort of like, because you know, Cristiano Ronaldo is, I feel, quite similar in that he doesn't make apologies for believing that he is very good at his craft. So even if you know, this sort of forced modesty is almost more off-putting than if he's actually been like, no, actually I was the best player on the Brazil team during this period.
And also because Pelé has been celebrated for this, right?
Yes.
Like, the end of the Mongol complex and everything, that he was the one who actually took the action, went out on the pitch, made it work.
He's also celebrated himself for it. I mean, it was a few years ago now, it's about 15 years, but he did a list. He was asked to do it for FIFA, a list of the greatest players in the world who were still alive. So he did a long list, and he didn't put, of all of the players he played with, most of whom were still alive, we've lost some of them since, he only put one, and that was his mate, Carlos Alberto, who was his mate. You know, all of the, like, Jairzinho and Gerson, and he didn't put any of them on. And it was like he was saying, you know, Mr. Toad did it all by himself. Yeah. All by himself. It was all me, you know. So
yeah, it's like he has in his mind the Maradona 1986 World Cup comparison, and therefore I will make a point.
Yes. So all of those who were saying that, you know, Maradona did it on his own, and I was surrounded by greats, they were wrong. You know, he was making that very clear then. He considers himself absolutely great, and let's be honest, he's got every reason to consider himself great. So, that's obviously on that. I think he's probably been badly advised.
Mm-hmm. One of the more, I think, more interesting aspects of the documentary is how it sort of touches upon Pelé's relationship to the military dictatorship while he was playing. Is this something that in Brazil people bring up as sort of a card to hold against him, or something that people, you know, when they are arguing about how great Pelé was, that people say actually this was something he could have done more, or is it something that's largely ignored?
Well, first, I think you have to bring some kind of context about the military dictatorship. As I say, I haven't seen the film, although people have told me lots about it. And it seems to me that it's not particularly nuanced or subtle. You know, it's a few scenes,
but then it's sort of very, so it's like it brings it. I don't know. Do you want to, how you feel about it, Liam? But it sort of introduces the brutal military dictatorship. Pelé kind of answers a couple of quick questions about, like, did you know what was going on? I didn't really feel it. And then it kind of breeds past it back to the main storyline.
Yeah, and you see him shaking hands with Medici.
That's
about the extent to which it's covered.
Yeah, I mean, the military dictatorship took place in took over in 64.
Yeah.
A lot of people have tried to overlook this, but it had massive support. Massive support. And a lot was made a few years later of a march of students against the military dictatorship of 100,000. Well, back in 64, when they took over, they were putting 1 million out on the streets, you know. So there was big support for this military government, which at the start was fairly moderate. As so often happens with authoritarian solutions, it becomes more authoritarian along the way. You know, there's a change of power inside the dictatorship. There's almost like a coup inside the coup. And from like 68 to 72, it's really hard line. And then the people are disappearing and so on. For the mass of the population, I can understand why. Because the fault line was between the government and the left-wing intelligentsia, the intellectuals. This is a lot less like the dictatorships of the 70s in Chile and Argentina, where it is all out war against working class associations, against trade unions and political parties and so on. In Brazil, the working class, the trade unions and so on were not so strong. The main fault line was middle class intellectuals. They're the ones who are dying and who are being tortured and who are suffering. Now, Pelé's not part of that world. For the majority of Brazilians, the feeling at the time and the rhetoric that's being ramped up at the time is that Brazil is enjoying an economic miracle. The 1970 World Cup is the first in Brazil that's seen on TV. That's significant because TV ownership is going whoosh because suddenly more people have money to buy TVs. So there was considerable support for the military dictatorship. And most people just kind of got on with their lives. It didn't touch them that much, but it did touch the middle-class intellectuals. Now, he's criticized in the film by Paulo César Caju, who's from a different generation. He's 10 years younger. So Paulo César has grown up, formed in some way by what's happened in the United States during the 60s. He's been radicalized by that. He's also from the Rio favelas in the rich area, very close to the middle-class intellectuals. And he's been taken under the wing of the middle-class intellectuals. He's almost like been adopted by them as the radicalized, politicized player. And that's formed his worldview. He's got every right. I know him. He's a fascinating character. Paulo César, and every right to his opinion, but his experiences are different from those of Pelé. Now, he comes from the backwaters, and the majority of Pelé's people, the people with whom he grew up, their lives haven't been as directly touched by the military dictatorship, as is the case with Paulo César, who has more contact with the middle-class intellectuals. I think trying to hang too much on that on Pelé is harsh. It's also trying to put too much importance on a sports star. You know, I mean, that kind of Superman idea that the sports star is going to change society. That's an infantile hope, I think. What might have been worth exploring, and I'm told that they didn't explore it in this documentary, is the 74 World Cup. Because years later, from a safe distance, Pelé said that he didn't play in 1974 as a protest against the military government. This was at a time when the military government was widely seen as a bad thing. Now, with Bolsonaro in power, there are those who think it was a good thing. You know, the history perspectives on history change through time. But that, I thought, was a silly declaration from Pelé, because I don't think it's true. If he did not play the World Cup as a protest, he didn't let anyone know. So what's the point? You know, if you're making a protest and no one knows you're protesting, what's the point? And I went in depth with this a fair few years, about 15 years ago now, with both Zagallo, who was the coach of the team, and Tostão. And they both gave different answers. Tostão's was, no, he didn't want to play 74 because he wanted to leave the stage on a high point of 1970, because even then he's obsessed with his legacy. Yeah. And Zagallo said, he's getting more money from, I think it was Pepsi that he signed a contract with in the States. He's getting more money from them. He doesn't need the money for us anymore. So that's why he didn't play. I think both of those are true. The legacy and the financial reasons. But there, I think Pelé lets himself down, making the false claim that he was protesting about the military government in 1974 from a safe distance. Yeah. I think that opens himself up to the charge of hypocrisy.
Has he ever had to? I know he sort of only really does interviews where it's sort of he can control the PR stuff, but has he ever had to answer further questions on this, or is it just sort of something that threw out once and then...
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the reasons I think he agreed to do this. I mean, I've never spoken to him. I wanted to. I tried to. when I was first here, this is in the mid-90s, when he was sports minister. Because obviously as sports minister, he has to be a bit more open to questioning. Yeah. And he gave an interview where he confessed that he hadn't done enough for footballers at the time. You know, at the time he was sports minister, he was pushing through legislation, giving footballers freedom of contract. You know, the Bosman thing for Brazilians, it's known as the Pelé law. And in an interview that he gave there, he just made this offhand remark, you know, yeah, when I was at the height of my, I had power there that I could have used, I should have used more to help other footballers. And I thought that was fascinating. For me, that kind of opened a door. And I wanted to do an interview with him then, just to, let's see if we can open that door wider. Let's see what we can get in there. So I got in touch with the ministry, and they would give me an interview, but I would have to go to New York to do it. And at the time, I didn't really have money to get a bus from one side of Rio to the other. So I had to abandon that idea. And then once he stopped being sports minister, I gave up that plan, because it was obviously not going to happen. But it would have been interesting back then, 25 years ago, when he was younger, fitter, sharper. It would have been interesting, I think, to have that dialogue.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's interesting about, you know, thinking about sort of athletes using their platforms very much in the news, especially like in the UK with Marcus Rashford and stuff like, and other outspoken athletes, you know, how we sort of judge athletes from a previous generation, because I know the comparison between Pelé and Muhammad Ali is quite often made because they're sort of peers, but I don't think it's usually, I feel like it's very easy for us to sort of go back and judge Pelé and say he should have done more for the sort of safety.
Yeah, I think the comparison with Ali is fascinating. Ali, firstly, he's operating in a context when the lines are very, very clear in terms of, you know, who is black and you know who is white. You know, there are states of the United States that were prohibiting black people from voting that had only just stopped lynching them. You know, if you had one black grandparent, you were black, you know. So, in a lot of the towns, the railway divides, you know, one side of the tracks is white, one side of the tracks is black, and so on. So you are, it's easy to know where the sides are.
Although the issue on Vietnam was more contentious.
Exactly.
And he was very outspoken on that,
too. Yes. So you've got those two things together. Clear racial divide, where it's clear who is who, and the Vietnam War. Pelé, Brazil, the situation is totally different. Who is black and who is white? It's a social divide. It's a much more subtle thing, you know. Many, many years ago, when I was first here, I used to give English lessons to a bloke. He worked in a financial market, and he was black, or in his case, I think his dad was white, but we would certainly consider himself black, and he considered himself black. And then every few years, they do a census, and people came around to ask questions, and he saw the fellow filling in white, and he said, "Well, hang on a minute, take that out. I'm not white. I'm black." And looking at him, you would certainly think he was black. But, you know, the fella said to him, "You can't be black. Look at where you live." You know, so Brazil is much more subtle. And there wasn't the question of Vietnam. It's very, very different. I mean, Ali there shows a kind of collective thing. You know, he was willing to sacrifice the peak years of his, he did sacrifice the peak years of his career for a political cause. And Pelé would never have done that, I think. But Ali is operating in a situation where it's very, very clear who the enemy are.
Yeah.
So that makes organizations so much easier.
No, of course. Although, I mean, part of it by the regime and the authoritarian measures in place at that time. So you had a group of minority where it was clear that pressure was on And also that there were clear social divides between that group and then everyone else in Brazil.
Yeah. Does that touch Pelé's life?
No, probably not to a large extent. But no. But yeah, but I was wondering because I don't feel the question was whether Pelé could have changed something meaningfully by resisting or doing something different. Probably more about whether some symbolic act of not shaking someone's hand or not, you know, becoming the face of some government would have been possible at that time, and whether that would have helped, and yeah, whether it was even on his radar.
No, I don't think so. It was on the radar of Tostão. Tostão was an exception. He was politicized then.
But they probably have talked. They talked yes. back then, right?
Yes. But again, you've got to remember that Brazil. And really, the father of modern Brazil, Getúlio Vargas, yeah. He was president between 1930 and 1954 with one interruption. He was president, both elected and also staging a coup. He staged a coup in the early 30s and ruled as a dictator for until the end of the Second World War, and then he came back in 1950. Very, very much a kind of benign Mussolini. A benign tropical Mussolini, and some of Brazil's legal code is just taken straight out of Italian fascist legislation. As I say, relatively benign. There's no militarism. There's no political party. So there are big differences between Vargas and Mussolini. But Vargas is an incredibly important figure as a father of the modern nation. In an extremely authoritarian way. And so what happened, you know, he shoots himself in 54, partly in a bid to stage off a coup, I think. And then in 64, you've got the military takeover.
Yeah.
So, you know, in all of the years of Pelé's life, most of it has been under authoritarian governments. It's normal.
Yeah.
You know, it's only from the perspective afterwards, you know, you look back afterwards and think, yeah, there was a military government, but at the time it was normal. That was the government. No, the fact that you haven't voted for them, it's authoritarian, is, you know, that's the government. And it would have been seen as extremely unpatriotic to speak against them in any way. It would have been a really, really radical act of someone entirely sure of his political position to take some action against Medici. I think Pelé's got the education at the time for that. You know, you're loading too much responsibility onto a sports star, I think.
No, I'm personally not sure whether
I'm not accusing you. I'm saying
the one fighting the fight, yeah. Because I feel like this is a recurring theme where sports persons who are on the public stage are being blamed for something. Well, you know, you have state leaders talking to autocratic leaders all the time, and so it is a difficult terrain, definitely. Yeah. And especially so for people who maybe did not have the education in especially these areas, to navigate this. But I do think, though, of course, there was a shift from the Brazil in the late 50s and early 60s, where everything was up and coming and developing, and then suddenly you have a military dictatorship and tortures are occurring more and more. So probably Pelé and everyone has witnessed that there was a change.
From the late 60s, but there is an economic miracle as well, and this is being really trumpeted. No, an economic miracle. Mm-hmm. People are living better. It's not until the 70s that the government finds itself in political problems. For two reasons. One, after the oil crisis, the external situation is harder, but also that economic miracle, it is not sustainable because it concentrates income too much. You're not widening sufficiently the income, as happened, say, in post-war Europe, where you widen the income and then you begin to get a self-generating economy because people have more money in their hands and they go and spend it. You know, in Brazil, it was still too, the wealth was still concentrated. And this has been the problem always, you know, and I'm not sure how they're going to get out of it. But for a long time, that regime had significant popular support, and this is a big difference, I think, from the current Bolsonaro government. That military regime, it came in with a project. It was genuinely interested in developing the country. There were lots of big infrastructure projects, the kind of stuff that these days, and even though Bolsonaro loves the military government, these days, those kind of state-run infrastructure projects would be dismissed as communism. That just shows how the political discourse has moved to the right over the last few decades.
Yeah, I'm conscious of your time. So just to, as you've done just there, bring it forward to today. I noticed how we sort of talked about football or sports that are sort of staying out of politics. And then sort of to compare that with a lot was sort of made in Western media of the support of Brazilian footballers for Bolsonaro when he was running for election. Has that support waned or changed or in the years since, or have some been more outspoken against him, or is it kind of more of the same?
Well, I can't believe that even he would vote for himself now. But he only would, you know. But I can't believe that even and the thing is, a calamity of incompetence or genuine malice. And honestly don't know. I'm terrified for this country sometimes because just rationality has gone out of the window. You know, in March the 22nd of last year, Bolsonaro gave his own measure of failure or success dealing with COVID when he predicted that the COVID total death toll in Brazil would not reach 800. You know, we're getting almost three times that number dying every day, almost a year later, and his analysis still hasn't changed. You know, so you know, when that kind of change of facts brings about no change of analysis, that's obviously evidence either of madness or of very, very bad intentions. I'm feeling a lot at the moment for Ronaldinho. Now, Ronaldinho, of course, he lost his father in tragic circumstances when he was very young. And I think that's something that had a strong effect on his career, on the precariousness of life, and enjoy yourself today because you never know what's going to happen tomorrow. Ronaldinho used his significant prestige to endorse Bolsonaro.
Yeah.
And his mother has just died of COVID. You know, I mean, he must, even at some subconscious level, be feeling guilty about the line of political action that he endorsed. He's not a specialist, but he doesn't have to give an opinion, and he gave his opinion. And his mother is now dead of COVID. I can only feel sorry for him, you know. And what a terrible, terrible thing to happen. One I know, I did CV with him once. Edgy Milson, the central midfielder or centre back, played for Barcelona. Mm. Very intelligent man, quite an impressive bloke, I think, an impressive man. But he's another one, his supporter. And whether that's still the case now, I don't know. But he was on the radio in Barcelona a few months back, you know, obviously in Barcelona because of the links in the fight against General Franco. They're appalled that, you know, Brazilian ex-players of Barcelona are supporting Bolsonaro. And he was asked, well, why are you supporting Bolsonaro? And his response was, well, he's a man of God. This kind of religious bullshit, it goes very deeply in Brazil, and a lot of the religious weirdos and fundamentalists and maniacs are still behind Bolsonaro. Whether there's been a significant change, I don't know. You would hope so. And especially when, what was it, 2 weeks ago, Bolsonaro said, well, we got to stop whinging and crying about all these people dying. You know, we just got to get, you know, think, for fuck's sake, it's a psychopath. It's an absolute psychopath. He's got nothing to offer. And that's the comparison between the now and the military government of 64, who did big in infrastructural projects. The economic program of Bolsonaro, which he doesn't understand, is privatize. You know, privatize, reduce job security, reduce wages. You know, this in a poor country like Brazil, it's been a disaster everywhere. You know, the neoliberal privatize and make everyone precarious has been a disaster in rich countries. You know, what it's going to do with Brazil, and that goes hand in hand with his, what it does seem to be his political priority, which is spreading arms around the population. Because, you know, there are one or two things going to happen in Brazil. Either it's going to be social inclusion, or, you know, you're going to, and this is the view of the rich, you're going to need guns to fend off all of those poor people. So you would hope that people of more people would have seen through him. I'm sure his support base is shrinking, but I fear that kind of social conservative message resonates very strongly with a lot of Brazil's footballers. You know, who've grown up in the evangelical churches, and so just the shit and the poison that they pour out, you know. And I've got a mate from Belgium, who a journalist who spends a lot of time in Brazil. He comes over here a lot, and he has much more patience for the old footballers than I have. And on the last time he was over, he was just in despair at them, and he was saying, you know, there's something that all of them are saying. If it's not them, it's their wives or something. They're saying, you know, today if you want to get a degree in a Brazilian university, you've got to be a drug-taking homosexual. And that kind of culture war thing is where Bolsonaro is very, very strong, you know, traditional values and so on. And football in Brazil is a very, very, very right-wing, socially conservative world.
How come? I wonder. Where does this come
from? Yeah, I would have thought of with the legacy of Socrates and some, you know, other people that I wouldn't be.
Middle-class intellectual. So what he was, you know, he was a middle-class intellectual, son of a bank manager. Because, and I think one of the tragedies of the neoliberal era is the destruction of the trade union movement. And the trade union movement was, and for many people, it was like a religion. There was a thing of human brotherhood in there. It was also a way by which an alternative narrative was spread throughout society. Know, a narrative of solidarity,
social interaction, empowerment.
And you see clearly, the north of England, places historically very associated with the Labour Party, voting for Boris Johnson in the last elections. What a lot of that has to do with, I think, is there's no trade union movement, there is no alternative narrative, so the narrative of nationalism plays even stronger. And in Brazil, where the that kind of trade union thing has always been weak as a kind of substitute religion, what you have is the real religion, Christianity. Well, I don't know if you've ever read any of it. I mean, there are some lovely things in there, but you know, it's absolute vile stuff. You know, and the New Testament is openly pro-slavery. The Law of Moses is openly pro-slavery. It's entirely anti-women. If a young woman is married as a virgin and she's not a virgin, then she should be stoned to death, and homosexuality as an unnatural act, and so on, and that kind of gibberish and obscurity and nonsense has a real pull in as this is apparently right, this is apparently morally correct, and anything else is sin and is a deviation from what is morally correct. And a lot of the Bolsonaro people would call themselves good citizens. That's one of their favorite phrases. They're citizens of good, as a kind of direct translation from the Portuguese. And that means kind of believers in the old hierarchy. Over the last few years, there has been progress in women's rights, homosexual rights, and so on. These are not necessarily left-wing causes. These are things that can happen perfectly well inside libertarianism, inside capitalism, because capitalism must create new markets, or it dies. So, you know, the power of the pink pound, as it's called in English, you know, homosexuals, it's a market and so on. So these are not necessarily left-wing causes, but they've been associated with the left in Brazil. Because the right is religion-based, very socially conservative. And a lot of the players have grown up in that environment. So Socrates was very, very much an exception. You know, well-read, well-studied, philosophical, upper middle class. So he's very, very much the
exception which proves the rule.
Yeah. There's not a lot of an alternative left wing pro solidarity, anti hierarchy view in Brazilian society generally. So there's not a lot for the footballers, not particularly educated or someone, just to latch onto. You know, the way that, say, Robbie Fowler in Liverpool back in the day, when he was a young kid without a lot of education, but he just automatically associated himself with a trade union struggle because that was the world that he'd grown up with, a world of solidarity and trade union struggle. That's not so much part of the experience of a lot of people in Brazilian football. Their experience is more being told that... questioning authorities is sinful.
Mm-hmm. How has that sort of has that manifested itself in the sort of Brazil team since Bolsonaro's come to power, like in the youth sides or something like this?
Not that I know of, although I mean, but they haven't played that much, you know, because of the pandemic. It's clear that the coach, that Chichi, is against.
Yeah,
very clear, and he doesn't make it obvious and explicit. But others on his coaching staff, there's a name I could mention. It's a name that you'll know, but I'm not going to mention it. Are rabidly in favour of Bolsonaro. So that's a dispute which may well be going on even inside Brazil's coaching staff.
Yeah. Okay. Cool. Well, I think that's everything that I wanted to cover. Do you have any final questions, Leon?
No concrete question. But I think it's very interesting, the thing that you tapped into, that if there's no such a thing as trade unions that create a point of social solidarity and interaction, and also social meaning, that then religion as a counterpart, you know, gains a lot of attractive force. But then I was wondering whether football in and of itself can't be part of an individual identity, something that does create a union, a bond between players, and helps them, you know, to spend time and fill their days with meaning, and that it somehow then has to latch on to like another thing such as religion or whatever to actually, you know, carry this forward.
It's a great point. When those of us who spend our time working with football, so often we think, you know, are we part of the problem or are we part of the solution? That's a vision of football that I love to have.
Yeah.
The idea of it creating links of solidarity between people from different nations and so on. And that exists.
Yeah.
But it also, you see the other side in Brazil and you see it so much because it's just all about winning. So, you know, I mean, players are regularly in Brazil attacked by their own fans, regularly, on even relatively successful teams. You know, it's one of the big things. You know, the airport. You know, when they come back after a humiliating defeat, or at the training ground after a humiliating defeat, groups of fans invading the airport, or invading the training ground, or even attacking the team bus when that happened with São Paulo a couple of months back that they were their team bus was attacked by its own fans on the way to a game.
Just wait till they're finished.
Yeah. Give them a chance.
So, yeah, exactly. So there's not a lot of solidarity there. If football is all about winning,
yeah,
then that solidarity goes. You know, if it's all about the result and not about the activity, then there's even less chance of creating that kind of solidarity.
Okay, so I think it's been an absolute pleasure, Tim. I've been enjoying the Brazilian Name podcast that you've been running recently. Would you like to tell our listeners a little bit about what that's about and what you cover?
Yeah, the Brazilian Shirt Name podcast is we pick a game from history, and we talk about the game and its meaning and its influence, but we also try and put it in a cultural context, especially with what was happening in music at that time. And it's a great chance to use football as a starting point to talk about other things. I spend enough of my time talking about football. So to use that as a starting point to then talk about what was happening musically, it's fun for us to do. We've had some great people. Sometimes it's just me and Dotton. Sometimes we bring in a guest. People seem to be really enjoying it. It's a different take, because as I say, it's not kind of in a nerdy way, just kind of restricted to the football. Yeah. We're trying to look out to especially what's happening in music, which often has absolutely nothing to do with what's happening in football. So and what's happening more widely in society, and which particular woman Dotton was seeing at the time, all of these things we can explore in the course of our podcast.
All right, Tim, thanks a lot again for joining us on the podcast, Tim. It's been absolute pleasure.
Yeah, thank you so much. That was so interesting. Well,
brilliant. Yes. Glad you enjoyed it.
Podcast Network.